This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 3, The War on Working People. Last week on Taking Aim, we discussed commercial real estate defaults. Then, on Friday, September 11th, just a few days later, the Wall Street Journal announced Chorus Bank is the latest to be seized by regulators. Federal regulators seized Chicago-based Chorus Bank, bringing to 91 the total failures this year and marking one of the first banks to be undone by deteriorating construction and commercial real estate loans. The branches and deposits of Chorus were assumed immediately by MB Financial. Chorus had concentrated heavily on condo construction lending in South Florida and other housing markets. More than half of the bank's $3.9 billion in condo construction loans were in non-accrual, that means default, or foreclosure in April. The defaults of the regional and the small banks that are focusing on commercial real estate loans has started. Ralph?
As the Wall Street Journal makes clear, Maya, Chorus's failure is what they call the latest sign that banks, small, mid-sized, regional, face what they call a new round of pain beyond the deteriorating home mortgages. And these construction loans accounted for 88% of Chorus's outstanding loans at the end of the first quarter, which is the largest share among any U.S. bank, according to Foresight Analytics. And then the journal states the following, Maya. Other commercial real estate sectors are getting clobbered by the recession, evidenced by the bankruptcy filings by General Growth Properties Incorporated and Extended Stay Hotels. The commercial real estate loans will trigger an additional $100 billion in losses at over 900 banks, according to an analysis by the Wall Street Journal. The journal states the Chorus failure does not come as a big surprise. Federal regulators that impose higher reserve requirements, giving the condo lender until mid-June to raise cash or find a buyer. The sale dragged out. Bidders worked over how to value the bank's sprawling condo assets. And the article documents that the Chorus catastrophe is the opening wedge for the whole commercial banking sector of this financial economy. It's round two, and it's come virtually on the heel of the presumptive recovery, outlining the beginnings of a new and even more substantial crash.
Here we have the Federal Reserve, the Treasury, and President Obama and his staff saying that recovery is underway. Recovery when we have the second wave of bank failures. Let's look at some of the commercial real estate that is collapsing. Bloomberg on August 10th, McGuire Properties, Inc., the largest office landlord in downtown Los Angeles, relinquished control of seven Southern California buildings. They relinquished this control in order to avoid filing for bankruptcy. The company told lenders, quote, it will no longer continue to fund the cash shortfall on the mortgages for the six properties, $1.06 billion of debt. Ralph?
Well, Maya, we have been attempting to explain to our brothers and sisters that the trumpeted recovery and the turnaround and the stock market boom, which was fueled by the $23 trillion, 24, handed over to the banks, was a charade. I remember that when we did an earlier program in this series, Maya, we cited the insight of Julie Haviv in Reuters in a piece on July 31st called Shadow Inventory Lurks Over U.S. Housing Recovery. And Julie Haviv opened her article presciently. The storm may have subsided, but the clouds continue to hover over the U.S. market as homeowners wait for prices to rise and get ready to flood the market with fresh inventory. The number of homes listed officially on the market, while at historically high levels, however, is only the tip of the iceberg, said Stan Humphreys. who was chief economist at the real estate website Zillow.com in Seattle. Zillow's latest home overconfidence survey showed 12% of homeowners said they would very likely put their home on the market in the next 12 months. And what this article showed was that over 20 million homeowners were going to be forced to sell, which is a startling statistic indicating that it's a vast percentage of the 93 million U.S. houses, condos, and co-ops. So what we saw already here in this prescient piece by Julie Haviv were all the signs that we attempted to highlight in our own broadcasting about the pending catastrophe.
Ralph, there was an article by Daniel Taub published May 6th. Almost a quarter of U.S. homeowners are underwater. A growing number of U.S. homeowners owe more than their properties are worth. About 21.8% of all homeowners are underwater as of March 31st. This is because property values dropped 14% from a year earlier. The decline has left 20.4 million people of the U.S.'s 93 million houses, condos, and co-ops with loans higher than the properties are worth. Ralph?
Well, Maya, actually, the figure was understated. Zillow disclosed that it was over 32%, and they tracked 161 metropolitan areas at that time. The handwriting was clearly on the wall. This crisis is only gathering steam here.
Ralph, there was an interesting article in the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, about debt-swapping Lemby, the biggest of the San Francisco landlords. Defaults, receiverships, and foreclosures are threatening to sink Lemby Group, Inc., which in the not-so-distant past owned more than 300 apartment buildings containing approximately 7,000 units throughout the city of San Francisco. The last time the Chronicle checked, 51 properties controlled by various Lemby Group entities were handed over to UBS, that's the Union Bank Suisse, which had lent Lemby up to $400 million. And then also, Lemby had turned over property to CIM Group of Los Angeles after Lemby defaulted on a $121 million loan. But as the Chronicle said, the waves keep crashing in. And the Chronicle discovered through the court filings in San Francisco Superior Court that more Lemby properties were ordered into receivership after Lemby failed to make payments on a $90 million note that was owed to Bank of America Corporation. The Chronicle, in another article, stated that the bubble had completely burst in San Francisco because nearly 75% of Class A premier office buildings downtown had been turned over in the past 4 years, that is, bought and sold, and the prices kept rising. And now the companies with vacant office space cannot meet the debt. In San Francisco, it is expected that another 30,000 to 40,000 jobs will be lost in the coming year. Ralph.
The signs, as we've been indicating, have been there for all with eyes to see. My house is worth less than my mortgage debt. The case of 33% of Americans. This was the alarm sounded by the International Business Times back on May 6th. And then we had McClatchy. What rebound? Foreclosure rises as jobs and income drop. That piece by Kevin Hall on August 20th is extremely important. Delinquency and foreclosure rates for U.S. mortgages continue to rise, with loans to the most qualified borrowers going bust at an unnerving clip. Notably in hard-hit states such as Florida and California, the numbers reported by the Mortgage Bankers Association show clearly that rising job losses are worsening the nation's housing troubles to a point of crisis and threatening the administration's efforts to protest the prospect of owners losing their homes. But the quarterly National Delinquency Survey showed that 1 in 10 homeowners with a mortgage are at least one payment late, while another 4% have already entered the foreclosure process on their loan. And the article documents, particularly in Florida and in California, In California, 11% of mortgages 90 days past due, 13.3% of U.S. mortgages ready for foreclosure. In Florida, 23% of all mortgages, 1 in 4, under threat of foreclosure. The catastrophe that is in preparation, all the signs have been there. The rising levels of unemployment over the next 9 to 12 months will be the primary impetus for the foreclosure activity. That's the wave that's just starting to hit. We're just starting to see the problems unfold now.
And Ralph, this was recognized by the New York Times. On the front page of its business section on August 28th, there was an article pinpointing Phoenix, boom to bust. It's written by John Collins Rudolph under the title Construction That Fueled Growth in the Sun Belt Slows, an understatement. Because what he says is that in a little more than 3 years, the Phoenix area has gone from the hottest of Sunbelt hotspots to one of the nation's economic disaster areas. And it's not alone in its rapid fall. After riding high during the boom, the Las Vegas area, parts of Southern California, and Southern California's inland counties have also been brought low by plunging payrolls, billions lost in housing wealth, a continuing epidemic of foreclosures, record government deficits, and stagnating populations. This, he says, to a degree, is unmatched in the rest of the country, but it is also happening elsewhere. Construction and real estate had taken place in Southern California and in Las Vegas and in Southern Florida based upon real estate growth for its own sake. Home prices are down 54% in Phoenix, and most of the jobs in Phoenix had relied on construction. Construction job losses, 45%. Real estate had fueled the economy. Ralph?
It's an empty fuel, if you want, because the power in that fuel is de minimis. Unemployment report, writes the New York Times of September 5th, signs of a jobless recovery. Talk about a contradiction in terms. The unemployment rate surged, signaling that joblessness and financial anxiety were enduring in millions of American homes. The Labor Department's latest employment report, write Peter Goodman and Jack Healy in the Times, have already escaped the grip of recession, but 216,000 net jobs vanished in 3 weeks. The report has lent credence to the deepening consensus that this recovery is so weak that there will be no hiring. In the context, quote, of a full-blooded recovery, this report is disappointing. We're clawing our way backwards. Many experts envision a jobless recovery in which the economy grows, but job losses deepen. Such an outcome will confront the administration with a huge problem, because in essence what's happening is that the worst-case projections are being exceeded with respect to unemployment, the viable income of the mass of the population. And that particular assessment in the New York Times on September 6th is amplified by the following. The nation is confronting a fundamentally weak economy, concludes the New York Times. Everybody is looking around saying, where is this recovery supposed to come from? We're not finding it. Heidi Shierholz, the economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, said, we're going to have elevated unemployment for years to come. Ginny Hoover, 49, remains unemployed since she lost her job at a pharmaceutical company in November 2007. She has maxed out her credit cards and borrowed money from friends. She broke her apartment lease and moved in with her boyfriend. But other than an offer to sell insurance door-to-door, she has no work. I thought maybe a month or two I'd have another job, said Miss Hoover. I never guessed it would be as brutal as it is. Manufacturing has shed 63,000 jobs, construction 65,000 jobs, I don't think these businesses will hire back, said Alan Sinai, chief global economist at Decision Economics. We are seeing what can be only called a jobless recovery.
Ralph, the Wall Street Journal headline that job losses were moderate did say that the Federal Reserve officials have grown more confident, that they thought that the worst economic downturn in decades was ending, that the federal officials saw growth resuming this year and expect a recovery to pick up in 2010. But in the same article, it cited the very figures that you gave and added that employment in the service sector, the main source of U.S. jobs, fell 80,000. Another article showed that there are fewer jobs in the United States today than existed in May 2000. Fewer jobs, but more people. So what does it mean when they talk about recovery? And what does it mean when they talk about unemployment, which keeps rising? And remember, the unemployment figure only shows people who are looking for work. So when you have a 9.5% unemployment rate, which has since risen to 9.7%, you end up with an effective unemployment rate of 16.5%. And what do I mean by effective unemployment? The unemployment rate, when it's announced by the U.S. Department of Labor, does not include those too discouraged to look for work, something we're going to discuss in the show, and those who are working part-time and working fewer hours than they would like. By adding the two groups to the unemployment rate, the rate becomes the effective unemployment rate.
It's 23%, Maya, across the board. It may be localized at 16, but the actual number of those who have stopped looking for work because there's no work to be found, or those who are working a fraction of the number of hours that have been normally considered full-time, has driven the percentage up to nearly a quarter of the population.
Yes, Ralph. Let's look at what it meant when the government was even saying that unemployment was 9.5%. You had to double it to get the effective rate. As again, that includes the officially unemployed workers, and then those who were considered the labor force reserve because they've abandoned their job searches, and the underemployed, those who are working part-time of necessity. Ralph?
Monster Meter poll reveals 34% of U.S. workers have 1 week or less of savings to cover expenses if laid off from work. Business Wire. Despite the fact that financial advisors caution workers to save the equivalent of 6 months' salary in preparation for unemployment, the Monster Meter poll reveals that one-third of U.S. workers have 1 week or less of savings to cover expenses if they are laid off from work. Over a one-week period beginning July 6th and running through July 13th, over 16,000 visitors to the Meter poll question responded, if you were laid off without severance, how long would your savings cover your living expenses? 34% reported they would have 1 week or less. And indeed, that number is understated because the percentage of those who don't respond but are in even more dire circumstances is equivalent. In effect, what we've got here is a demonstration that the jobless recovery will result in people going into foreclosure at ever-accelerating rates. Loss of income, loss of home feeds upon itself. It consequently leads to a social catastrophe for the working population of this country.
And more we're seeing articles in the press describing this social catastrophe. The New York Times, for instance, has been publishing an article that addresses the effective unemployment rate. Two particular articles that appeared recently, Out of Work and Too Down to Search On by Michael Luau, September 7th, and then Big Spenders They Wish by Peter S. Goodman on September 13th, is adapted from his new book, Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. In each of these, they give case studies of people who would have liked to work, but are out of work, and what it has meant, how they have become homeless. Ralph?
They were left out of the latest unemployment rate, as they are every month, Michael Luau writes. millions upon millions of hidden casualties of this Great Recession, not counted in the rate because they have stopped looking for work. That does not mean these discouraged Americans do not want to be employed. As interviews with them demonstrate, they desperately long for a job, but their inability to find one day after day have made them the ultimate embodiment of pessimism. They have halted their job searches out of sheer frustration. They have decided it makes more sense to try to become stay-at-home fathers and mothers. When you were in high school and kept asking the head cheerleader out for a date and she kept saying no, at some point you stopped asking her. It becomes a why bother scenario. The official jobless rate, which garners the attention from politicians, was reported to have risen to close to 10%. But when you actually look at the number of people who are not able to find work and stop looking, the figure doubles. And the Bureau has a broader category of jobless, which it calls marginally attached to the labor force, which describes the condition of what is called a discouraged workforce, those who have stopped looking because there's no work to be found. There were 2.3 million people in this group in August, up over 1 million workers. Even this figure, the Times tells us, is an undercount of the extent of the jobless in this country. There are 1.4 million people who are not in the labor force when the session began. They are retirees, they are parents, people on disability, but many of these people have given up because the economy has taken that work away, the Times writes.
And Ralph, this figure doesn't include the accumulation of people who would have been in the labor force, but now have chosen alternative work, precarious work. For instance, I know someone who was a union electrician. He could not get work as a union electrician on construction projects, and now he works as an ad hoc handyman. Or people who have developed online eBay businesses trying to buy and sell items on the internet. People who have taken up arts and crafts and tried to market their wares. And then people who start very small businesses, such as pushcart vendors of food. People on the street trying to sell jewelry. All these are non-reported labor. People who would have been and had been in the labor force, but over the years have not been able to find work, are discouraged, and now are trying to make ends meet whatever way they can. Ralph.
World Socialist website on August 10th, an article by Tom Ailey. Working Poor Report. 30% of U.S. families subsist on poverty wages. A report released in October reveals that more than 28% of American families with one or both parents are living in poverty. The report, Still Working Hard, Still Falling Short, is based on data for the period from 2004-2006 and doesn't even take into account the huge number of additional unemployed arising from this current economic collapse. The report finds that 10 million households can be described as low income or working poor, defined as families that earn less than 200% of the official poverty level. There were 350,000 more such families in 2006 than in 2002. 21 million children are added to the low-income working families. That's an increase of 800,000. Over 29 million are paid below the official poverty level, an increase of nearly 5 million poverty wage jobs. Family income inequality has increased drastically. In 2006, the top 20% of U.S. households earned, on average, 9.2 times as much as the bottom quintile. This is disappearing. A struggle exacerbated by soaring prices for food, gas, health, and education. 60% of low-income working families are forced to spend more than one-third of their income on housing. 40% lack health insurance. They struggle under poverty conditions despite parents working long hours. Adults and low-income working families work on an average 2,552 hours per year, the equivalent of 1 1/4 full-time workers. The total is 1/3 of all the hours that pass in a year. It is twice the total yearly work hours of the average German worker. It is 162 hours more than the average South Korean worker. Is this a result of decades of corporate downsizing, the wage cutting presided over by the Democratic and Republican administrations? It shows that poverty-level jobs are increasing and held by broader sections of the population. The majority of families living on poverty wages are not immigrants, minorities, or families with a single parent. 72% of poor families hold jobs. Half of them are headed by married couples. 69% have only American-born parents. 89% have a parent between the ages of 25 and 54. 43% have white non-Hispanic parents. The statistics for African-Americans and Hispanics and immigrants are vastly higher. 25% of this white population receives food stamp assistance, 25%, one out of four. The study breaks its statistics down to the state level. The conditions of working families are worse in the South and the non-Pacific West. Texas is the fourth highest number of working families as low income. New York is rapidly declining as well. In California, the impoverishment of ever larger sections of the working class is the outcome of a number of processes, the dismantling of large sections of basic industry, a wave of union busting, and strike breaking. The article is extraordinarily precise. This is the greatest concentration of decline since the onset of the Great Depression in 1928, when 24% of the national income went to the top percentile. Maya?
Ralph, and this study was based upon census data from 2004 through 2006. This is prior to the collapse, the speculation collapse of 2007. The circumstances would be even greater today. Ralph, I'd like to refer to an article written by Holly Sklar in Zenit, July 25, 2009, because it gives some insight into why there are so many impoverished working people. Minimum wage stuck in the 1950s. The minimum wage recently was raised from $6.55, this is the federal minimum wage, to $7.25 in July. And Holly Sklar asks, are you better off than you were 40 years ago? Not if you're a minimum wage worker, she answers. It would take $9.92 today to match the buying power of the minimum wage at its peak in 1968, the year Martin Luther King died fighting for living wages for sanitation workers. In today's dollars, the 1968 hourly minimum wage adds up to $20,634 a year working full-time. The new federal minimum wage of $7.25 comes up to just $15,080. That's $5,554 in lost wages. So are you better off than you were 40 years ago? Not so if you are a minimum wage worker. Ralph?
The long-term fall in worker buying power is the reason, one of the principal reasons, we are in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 3, The War on Working People. Ralph?
What we've got here is an accelerated war on the most disadvantaged, which is increasingly a substantial part of the entire workforce. On the 5th of September, Catherine Rampell in the New York Times applied this to the young. Teenless jobless rate reaches record high. Pity the unemployed, but pity especially the young and unemployed. The teenage unemployment rate, the percentage of teenagers who want a job but cannot find one, is 25.5%, its highest level since the government began keeping track of such statistics in 1948. Likewise, the percentage of teenagers overall who are working is at its lowest level in recorded history. There are an amazing number of kids out there looking for work, said Andrew Sum, an economics professor at Northeastern University. And given that unemployment is a lagging indicator, and young people's unemployment lags behind the rest of unemployment, we are seeing a huge number of kids out of work for a long, 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 long time, unquote. This article as a documentation of how the new wave of young workers is being set up for a catastrophic inability to find the means of sustaining themselves. Expect record unemployment among youth, the article says. Economists say that young workers are suffering so much in this downturn because they have been cast at the bottom of the totem pole. The reluctance or inability of older workers to retire has led to less attrition, and high teenage jobless rates are distorted by other factors because more young people have to rely on family, and consequently their reliance on family is a result of no work being found, and they decide, as do so many others who cannot find work, that it is impossible to do so.
Now remember, Ralph, she's writing about teenage workers. This includes high school students and college students, young people who should be fulfilling their educational needs, not out in the workforce. 1 in 4 teenagers cannot find a job. And there was a startling statistic in her article that 1/2 of young college students work 20 hours a week. 20 hours a week. That's a half-time position of a normal work week. When do they have time for their classes and to study? The AFL-CIO on Labor Day issued an important study on young workers. They called it Young Workers, the Lost Decade. By young workers, they're talking about people in the workforce who are under 35 years of age. 31% of young workers report being uninsured, up from 24% 10 years ago. Only 47% have retirement plans at work, and that's down 6 percentage points from 1999. The most startling statistic in the AFL-CIO study is that 31%, almost one-third of young workers, only make enough money to cover their bills, but not to put it any aside. 24%, that's almost 1 in 4, make less than they need to pay their monthly bills. Ralph?
A scary reality, writes Bob Herbert in the New York Times on October 11th. For American workers peering anxiously through their family portholes, the economic ship is sinking. You can put whatever gloss you want on these numbers. The truth is that they may have been a bit better than some economists were expecting, but in reality they are bad, bad, bad. Jobs lost in July, the smallest monthly loss of jobs since the summer, but the monthly unemployment rate did not incorporate those who have stopped looking. The American economy is not providing jobs. It is not providing a standard of living that will sustain Americans. The country has lost a crippling 6.7 million jobs since the recession began. No one predicts a recovery in the foreseeable future. Analysts at the Economic Policy Institute note that this economy has fewer jobs around than in recorded memory, even though the labor force has grown by around 12 million workers since then. Two issues that absolutely undermine any rosy assessment of last week's unemployment report are the swelling ranks of the long-term unemployed and the crushing levels of joblessness among young workers, young Americans. More than 5 million workers, one-third of the unemployed, have been jobless for over 6 months, the highest number recorded since accurate records have been kept. A scary reality, writes Bob Herbert. Here is the World Socialist website. A rising tide of social misery. Contrary to Obama administration and media claims about a recession easing, growing millions of working Americans are losing their jobs, earnings, and health care benefits at an accelerating rate. While executives at Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and financial giants prepare to pay themselves billions of dollars in salaries and bonuses, life has become extraordinarily difficult for the broadest layers of the population. The New York Times pointed out that in California, 1 out of every 5 people who would like to be working is not now doing so. If these unemployed and underemployed were included, the real jobless rate in this country's most populous state would be 21%, according to the Times. In Oregon, 23.5%. In Michigan and Rhode Island, 21.5%. In South Carolina, 24.5%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics' national jobless rate is skewed for political reasons to minimize the actual conditions. The Center for Labor Studies at Boston's Northeastern University places the current jobless rate at 18% higher than the official figure on the eve of World War II. John Williams of Shadow Government Statistics puts the alternative unemployment rate at 20.6%. The effective unemployment rate is even greater. The army of unemployed is large and swelling. A great many lives have already been devastated.
Ralph, we can see this reflected in the number of people who are applying for food stamps. The Financial Times, on September 4th, Sarah O'Connor reporting, U.S. families turn to food stamps as wages drop. She's not even talking about people who are unemployed. What she's talking about is the number of working Americans turning to the free government food stamp program, and that number has surged as their hours and wages erode. 40% of families now collecting food stamps have earned income. The Financial Times reports, this is up 25% from 2 years ago. Agriculture Department, which runs the program, itself attributes this to the rise in workers having their hours cut back. Less attention is often paid to the people who are still in the workforce, whose incomes are also being squeezed. The average work week is now 33 hours, the lowest on record. And the number forced to work part-time because they can't find full-time work has risen more than 50% in the past year. Wages and benefits have also decelerated, with many companies now increasing the copayment on health insurance. So we have here in the Financial Times reporting that 40% of families on food stamps have earned income. And what does it mean in terms of the number of people in the United States collecting food stamps? 1 in 9 Americans now relies on food stamps as of last May. This is reported by the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which reports for the Department of Agriculture on the food stamp data. In all, 34.4 million people use the federal program that provides assistance to low-income people. This is an increase of 6 million people over the past year. And the increase in May was the sixth consecutive month that set a new record in food stamp use. Ralph?
Unemployment crisis grips U.S. states, writes the World Socialist website. The unemployment rate has increased in 48 of 50 states in Washington, D.C., according to the U.S. Department of Labor Statistics. The jobless rate has increased in every state, and in 8 states it is the highest level in 40 years. The state of Michigan had the highest unemployment rate in the nation at 14.1%, not including those who are on part-time work who are stopped looking for work. Those figures are nearly matched in Indiana and Ohio, devastated by the shutdown of auto plants. The Midwest has an unemployment rate that is comparable. Kentucky, and in California, the nation's most populous state with 37 million residents, they have lost the largest number of jobs. Its unemployment rate, without taking into account part-time workers or those who have stopped looking, is 11.5%, the highest level on record and an enormous increase over May 2008. Among the regions, the West Coast has the highest jobless rate. Oregon, with the second highest unemployment rate, saw an increase to 12.4%. And that process continues in Florida, the fourth most populous state. It is, in fact, across the country. The official rate belies the true scope of unemployment by removing from the workforce count a huge number of workers who are inactive or, quote, discouraged, unquote, and seeking work, and by counting as employed those who are only able to get part-time hours or a few hours a week. While state-to-state statistics with this definition of unemployment are being concealed, the real unemployment rate in Michigan is over 25%, and in California, it is nearly the same. On a national level, the broader rate of unemployment and underemployment was 17% in May and rising rapidly. These are near-depression-level statistics.
Ralph, I want to return to the issue of food insecurity. We refer to people who are unemployed, people who have been losing their homes as a consequence, and now the factor of people not having enough to eat. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities put on its website, Second Harvest, information about food insecurity. 36.2 million Americans are considered food insecure, including 12.4 million children. They comprise 13 million or 11.1%, that's more than 1 in 10 households. 4.7 million households experience, quote, very low food security, meaning hunger is a persistent problem. Households with children have double the food insecurity as ones with none. Single women-headed households are the worst off, with 30.2%, almost one-third of them, food insecure. 53.9% of food insecure households rely on one or more of the following federal programs. We spoke of food stamps, but there are other programs. For instance, the National School Lunch Program and the Special Supplement Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, WIC. In addition, Feeding America in 2007 provided emergency aid to 25 million low-income people, 8% more than in 2001. Ralph.
The number of working Americans turning to free government food stamp has surged as their hours and wages erode, and a stark sign that the recession is inflicting pain on the employed as well as the newly jobless. And that is amplified by the following report. The United States income gap is now the widest since 1917. The social chasm separating America's financial oligarchy from working people, writes the World Socialist website on August 19th, the vast majority of the population is wider than at any time since 1917, according to statistics from the Internal Revenue Service. The income gap between the top 10% and the bottom 90% has, quote, reached a level higher than in any year since 1917, and it surpasses 1928, the peak of the stock market bubble in the roaring 1920s, according to an analysis of the data published this month by the University of California economist Emmanuel Saez. His report, Striking It Richer, The Evolution of Top Incomes in the U.S., shows that the real increase in the concentration of wealth has taken place at the pinnacle of the social pyramid, the top 1% of the population. Between 2002 and 2006, this social layer, consisting of 1 out of 100 households, accounts for 65% of income growth nationwide. Well, that actually, brothers and sisters, is an underestimate, because, in fact, we have the data now that 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the rest of the population combined. And not only is it a statistic of such magnitude, but the L curve demonstrates that the top 1% has to be broken down itself, because one half of the 1% has 70% of that ownership and income. The top 1% is now estimated to own between 40 and 50% of the nation's wealth, which, as I said, is, quote, more than the combined wealth of the bottom 95% of the population. And the top and bottom halves of the top 0.5% show an even greater disparity, as I just indicated. What we are addressing here is a class war of huge proportions. The 2008 U.S. Census shows, accordingly, sharp increases in poverty.
Ralph, the number living below the official poverty threshold increased in 2008 by 1.5 million people to 38.8 million. This is a number equivalent to 12.7% of the population. That's almost 1 in 8 people in the United States living below the official poverty threshold. The Census Bureau counts a family of four as impoverished if its pre-tax income falls below $21,660. For an individual, the figure is $10,830. But a more accurate measure of poverty is preferred by many sociologists and advocacy groups, and that places the threshold at 200% of the official measure. If you use this guide, New York State's 2007 official poverty rate, for instance, is 14.5%. But if you use the method preferred by sociologists and advocacy groups, that is 200% of the official measure, New York State's 2007 poverty rate, 31.9% of the population. Ralph?
The Census Bureau, as cited by Sean Fremstead in the Center for Economic and Policy Research on September 9th, working-class families have been particularly hard hit. The decline in real income between 2007 and 2008 is the largest single-year decline in the 40 years of median income data on record and the 60 years of family median income data that have been recorded. The report documents a decline in health insurance coverage amongst families earning $50,000 to $75,000 a year. Below that, it has disappeared. A key issue in so-called health care reform is whether to provide insurance subsidies to people with incomes between 300 and 400% of the federal poverty threshold. But in reality, none of that is going to occur. The real median household income for working people is falling, free-falling, at a drastic rate.
Ralph, this was even acknowledged by the Department of Treasury. The major findings on the 10-year uninsurance rates for non-elderly Americans, most elderly Americans are covered by Medicare. 48%, that's almost half, are uninsured at some point over a 10-year period. 41% go without coverage for at least 6 months over a 10-year period. And 36% go without coverage for at least 1 year over that 10-year span. 53% of Americans in rural areas go without insurance over a 10-year span. And 45% of Americans with household incomes between $50,000 and $100,000 go without insurance at some point over a 10-year span. We've discussed housing. We've discussed food. And we're discussing health care. Thousands of people attended a free health clinic in Los Angeles. The clinic lasted between August 11th and August 18th. During the first 4 days of operation, the nonprofit Remote Area Medical, RAM, which had been set up to provide free medical care to remote areas of South America, came to Los Angeles and provided care to 3,000 attendees in only the first 4 days. RAM had been organized by Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom program host, Stan Brock. It has expanded its operations now to the United States, where 47 million people, medical care is effectively unavailable, as it is to a villager in the farthest reaches of the Amazon. RAM previously had provided services in New Orleans during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, but now it is coming to cities across the United States. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the workforce suicides are now up by 28%. Workplace suicides reported in 2008 rose by 28%, and they are increasing at a rapid rate. Overall, workplace fatalities are a measure of the desperation of people, the stress under which they are operating, and the conditions which are obtaining in their forced labor, in the sense that they have to put in more time, they have to put in time without overtime compensation as they lose pensions and health care. The stress under which they labor because of their concern that their jobs will be taken are exacerbating the stress, mental and emotional. 1 in 9 Americans uses food stamps, the highest proportion ever, according to released data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And all 34 million people use the so-called Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, a federal program that provided assistance to low-income people. By every criterion, the stress is part of a war. Here's the New York Times. Long wait for the unemployment check. Hundreds of thousands of people wait months for an unemployment check as the recession has doubled the number of jobless Americans. And 16 states that pay benefits with borrowed cash, a number that will double by the year's end. The call centers are so overwhelmed that workers have to fight for days just to file the application. They are waiting, they are waiting, they are waiting, and the unemployment check does not arrive. In reality, brothers and sisters, what Emily Spence calls the widening gap in America's two-tiered society has reached proportions that are, in fact, of a greater character that existed at the time of the French Revolution. These disparities in the enormous concentration of wealth in the hands of the privileged few and the mass of our population are of historic dimensions.
Ralph, and as bad as these statistics are, it's even worse for people of color. The Recession's Racial Divide, an article by Barbara Ehrenreich and Diedrich Mohammed, an op-ed contribution to the New York Times on September 13, 2009, pointed out, blacks are taking the brunt of the recession, with disproportionately high levels of foreclosures and unemployment. And they weren't doing so well to begin with. At the start of the recession, 33% of the black middle class was already in danger of falling to a lower economic level, according to a study by the Institute of Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis and Demos, a nonpartisan public policy research organization. For African Americans, the recession occurred from 2000 to 2007, as black employment decreased by 2.4% and incomes declined by 2.9%. During those 7 years, 2000 to 2007, one-third of African-American children lived in poverty, and African-American unemployment, even among college graduates, consistently ran at twice the level of white employment. This is a startling article, and it gets even worse. Black unemployment. By 2010, according to Lawrence Mitchell of the Economic Policy Institute, 40% of African Americans nationwide will have endured patches of unemployment or underemployment. Ralph?
The Schwarzenegger administration in California, in collaboration with the Democratic-controlled state legislature, carried out an unprecedented attack on the population at large with the backing of the Obama administration. They seized upon an economic crisis gripping the state to gut all basic social programs. That included the state welfare program serving 1.3 million people. It included medical coverage for hundreds of thousands of poor children. California is now 43rd in education. California's state social services are below those of Mississippi. There is no solution to the crisis within California alone. The problems that confront the state, which are generalized in states across the United States, are a result of the failure of the economic order called capitalism. The only means through which working people can resist this, restore a viable life for themselves, is to address the systemic nature of this crisis and to organize to remove those in power and replace the social order. Let's be clear, brothers and sisters, this is deep, this is systemic, this is sustained, this is not going away. What it requires is a revolutionary removal of those in power. The mass of our population are the direct target of this class war. It is only the little beginning. But that struggle, which is required, will be drawing on that experience and that anger and that determination to have a better life. The struggle for us is ahead.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 3, The War on Working People, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Please contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net.